This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes. Type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, today we've got a real exciting show. This is an area that I personally have a big interest in, and that is the whole kind of secret process of finding brokers who give you these wonderful pocket listings that nobody else has seen yet, and being able to actually acquire one of those. And I'm going to talk to someone who has a great deal of experience in this side. This is Michael Becker, who has been featured on Old Dogs episodes 002 and 067, which I would highly recommend you listening to. One kind of shares his story, and the other, he brings his friend Paul Peebles on, who is his co-host on the Old Capital podcast, and they talk all about how to love your banker or how to get your banker to love you. I think it's probably a two-way process here, but let me just tell you a little bit about Michael. He has two roles in commercial real estate. He is affiliated with the Old Capital Lending as a senior director of mortgage origination, and he's a principal at SPI Advisory LLC. SPI Advisory owns and manages, get this, over 4,300 apartment units in Texas. Michael heads SPI's Frisco, Texas office, where he oversees all aspects of property operations, including asset management, property management oversight, accounting and taxation, capital improvement and renovation of projects, and investor relations. Mike is a 15-year veteran commercial real estate banker and has originated and managed numerous portfolios of permanent and bridge loans in all major classes. Over the last 5 years of his banking tenure, Michael focused exclusively on multifamily properties, where he was the number one loan producer for his division at a top three national lender for the last three consecutive years. He's a lifelong resident of North Texas and a graduate of the University of North Texas with a BA in finance. He's married and has two young children. I want to emphasize this fact, too, that not only is Mike a heck of a nice guy, but you know, he's a guy that was on the banking side of things for so long, and he learned a lot there. I mean, just the underwriting and just what qualifies a property and a borrower and all these aspects. And then he moved into the acquisition side and started buying up apartment buildings. So he's got a great story to tell. The way I even heard about Mike was through Old Capital Podcast. Now, this is one some folks may have not heard of before, but if you haven't, you need to listen to this. It's on iTunes, and you can go there and just type in Old Capital. It's a show that he and Paul Peebles host. And the great thing I loved about this show when I first heard it is the fact that they talk with real everyday people, just like you and I, and a lot of people just starting out. They would talk from the standpoint of you're moving into this area. What did they have to do to qualify for the loan? What kind of loan did they get? And what other requirements were necessary? And I love the show. I think it's real informative, but it also helps us investors. And we really kind of see behind the scenes what the bankers really want. So I highly recommend you guys, if you haven't listened to that show, to listen to it. All that to say, welcome, Michael, to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having me back on.
Oh, it's great. Well, this topic to me is a big one, and I think we could spend many episodes on it. But right now, we're kind of working with the title here. It's how to work with brokers to buy apartments and find off market deals. So maybe I might condense it down, you know, to maybe three or five words. But basically, that's really what we're going to be talking about today. And I can't think of anybody else that would know better how to do that. So maybe you can just tell us just a little bit about how you got into this and just going gangbusters and not even 4 years acquiring 4,000 units. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah. So as you kind of read my bio, my background is in banking. So I had the advantage of having a profession where all I did all day long was underwrite and analyze multifamily transactions to make loans on. And then through that, I got to get networked with a lot of owners and operators, as well as the brokers and the management companies, and all the vendors that kind of serviced the business in North Texas and the DFW area where I'm located. So I really got to establish a bunch of relationships and look at a lot of deals on someone else's nickel. So really, it was a great way to kind of view the world. And through that process, you know, one of the things I realized that I was, you know, basically on the wrong side of every transaction. That it was in most cases, it's almost always better to be the borrower than the lender. So as you referred to, I went out and did something about it. And over the last about 4 years now, we've done almost 4,300 units, 21 transactions. I think we bought 21 deals now, about 4,300 units. So really kind of hit the ground running. And, you know, the business is kind of evolved as we scaled up and done bigger and larger deals, but kind of the fundamentals of it have kind of remained the same, and how you find deals maybe evolved a little bit, but for the most part, you know, the brokers control the majority of the deals, both on and off market. So having good working relationship with them, having, you know, a good reputation in the marketplace, those are all real critical things for you to be able to get access to these deals.
That's great. Now, these brokers that you're dealing with, when you started moving into the acquisition side of things, did you already have folks that you knew pretty much on a first name basis that you could pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm looking to buy?
So what I had was I had relationships with these guys just by being a lender in the marketplace. So the one thing I had is most of these guys knew who I was because I was a really active lender. And they, if you think about it, they don't get paid until the loan until the property sells and closes, and they get paid on a settlement statement, and none of that's going to happen unless I give them my loan. So I was a key cog to the whole system over there for sure. So they all knew who I was, but what I had to do was take my slotting that they had of me in the marketplace as a banker, and then try to change their perception on me from not just a banker, but to be a principal in these deals and someone that can go out and actually raise money and take them down. So that was my challenge more than trying to figure out who they were.
Had you already started raising money before you started looking for your first deals?
No. So kind of my origins when we first started doing deals was once I decided that was something that I wanted to do. And before I ever did apartments, I was like most people, or a lot of people, when I go out and start doing real estate investing, you start with small single family homes. And that's pretty much what my story was as well. I went out and did 16 rent houses where I just buy foreclosures, renovate them, and then lease them out. And so I had 16 of those before I ever went out and did an apartment complex. So that was really kind of my background. And when I decided to make the move, I had made a loan a couple years before to to a client who was based in Los Angeles buying a property in Dallas where I am based. And I flew out to go meet him. And through that process, he had a broker that he was working for that was working for him and helped him find the deal in Dallas. And I went out there and now met my now business partner, a guy named Sean Mabrak. And Sean was working for a broker out of the Los Angeles area. And we'd met. And then when they fast forward about a year or so later, they were needing to have someone in the local marketplace in Dallas put some money in some deals and kind of what we call asset manage the deals, kind of manage the management company, oversee the renovations, do the tax returns, things like that. So I was just kind of happened to be at the right place at the right time. And the relationship I had established about a year earlier, I kind of went and approached them and we ended up striking a deal. And that's how I did the first four deals I did, was why I was still a full-time banker. I just had some a group out of California that had a bunch of high net worth individuals that wanted to buy a property in Dallas, and I was able to kind of serve that asset management role and get kind of my feet wet and get into the business that way.
So was that a syndicated deal or a JV deal? What?
So I would probably consider that more like a JV deal. So it was really just typically one high net worth individual and then myself, and then we'd kind of partner together. And then when I first went into it, even though I was a banker, I didn't have previous multifamily ownership experience, even though that's all I did all day, every day.
Really?
And as I mentioned, when, on the previous podcast we did with you, when you go out and try to get a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan, they want to have someone with previous multifamily ownership experience. So what I did is actually brought in a principal with the management company that we hired who had some previous multifamily ownership experience. And so he signed a note with myself and then the high net worth individual from Los Angeles. And that's kind of how we put the puzzle pieces together to form the puzzle and get the deal done. Is I actually had to bring in someone from the management company signing the note with me. And that's what we did to get the first several deals done.
Great. Now, I assume, though, you're syndicating on pretty much all the deals that you're doing now?
Yeah, so we'll still do some joint ventures with high net worth individuals. So typically if someone's from, California seems to be a pretty fertile ground for a lot of rich guys. So we go, we have three or four of those rich guys that are based out of Los Angeles, Orange County, that will come bring their money to Dallas and we'll just do a deal with them and us. But then probably half or maybe even more than half now are just syndicated deals. For example, last deal we did, we raised, I think, $8.4 million from about 65 people. So it was kind of real fragmented ownership, $100,000 minimum. So a little here, a little there, kind of added up to $8.4 million from 65 people.
Okay, gotcha. Now, I mean, the thing that I think every investor that buys multifamily seeks out, sort of the holy grail here, is the off-market deal or the pocket listing. This is something that doesn't go into a LoopNet. It doesn't go out in the public, and you have the opportunity, or those that are lucky enough to get this offer, they're able to actually bid on it behind the scenes, getting that from what I've seen as a new investor in multifamily people. It's difficult unless you've got a track record, because a lot of these guys won't talk to you. But first off, I wanted to kind of find out why would they want to sell it? You would think they'd want to go out into the open marketplace and get it bid up and like an offering member.
Yeah.
And get it bidding up as high as they can get it to the best price they can get.
So let me first start with the saying I like to say: this is a completely unfair business, right? So the people with the track record, the people that have money, the people that have other chips to trade with the brokers that control most of the deals, they're going to get their unfair share of the business. So that's just kind of how it is. There's no participation trophies in this business. So, it's pass or fails results. And, the only thing that really matters is getting skins on the wall. So you're going to have to kind of come to reality with that if you want to get into this business. It's just completely unfair. So what you need to do is work on positioning yourself to become the person that gets their unfair share and get, win more deals that way than they lose. Because I've been on both sides of it. I got deals where I've certainly gotten because of relationships or something that, I can trade with the broker, and I feel like I've been screwed on some deals I thought I should have gotten, and you know, I just think I've gotten more than I haven't. And then so it's another thing to kind of set the table. You know, we've done 21 acquisitions, and of those, I think 16 or 17 of them have been off market. So we've been really putting a lot of effort and focus, and have had a lot of good results doing off market deals. So to your question, was why would a seller sell a deal off market in the first place? Wouldn't they just always be better off taking it to the full market, exposing it, and getting into a bidding war, especially in an environment like we've been in the last few years? Some of the main reasons would be some of the common things I've seen that kind of are similar across the board to people that sold to us would be that these are people that a lot of them are owner managers, meaning I go buy a property, I raise capital, and I hire a third-party management company to manage my properties. Well, a lot of these people that we bought off of kind of mom and pop it, so maybe they only own one deal or they own a handful of deals, and they directly manage the on-site staff, and they have a personal relationship with the on-site staff. And when you go and you go sell these properties, usually the on-site staff through that process will lose their job when the new team comes in and kind of replaces them. Not always, but more times than not. So the on-site staff gets nervous, and that would be something that the owner would have to deal with more so, where if you get a little bit group like set up kind of like mine, or a real big group with multiple layers in their management team, you know, I don't really necessarily have a personal relationship with anyone that's on-site with my property. So it's not that big a deal to me. So I would certainly almost always go through the process of doing a full marketed listing. Another thing would be you have some sort of timing constraint where you have like a loan that's coming due and you just woke up one day and realized, well, crap, my loan's coming due in 3 or 4 months. I got to get this thing sold. And you might not have the time it takes to go through a full marketing process, bid it out, get it into contract, and then wait for it to, you know, close. You just might have a time constraint where your loan comes due. That's another reason why I've seen a lot of people go out and try to just sell these deals off market versus marketing them. And then another reason would be you have a lot of deferred maintenance, or the current owner's undercapitalizing their deal and it just doesn't show very well. So if they can go get what they feel like a fair offer without having to put some money in and kind of sprucing it up, that would be another reason why I've seen a lot of people sell, or that's reasons why people have sold to us.
That's great. I didn't realize that. I didn't even think about that. That's great. One thing that I know that going into these deals, especially if you're trying to develop relationships with brokers, and is to, before you talk to them, to sound like at least you know what you're doing, that understanding your investment criteria, developing a 60-second pitch, you know, an elevator pitch as they refer to it, which really outlines what that is. How critical is that, and is that something that you use on a regular basis?
Yeah. So, Bill, as you mentioned, if you don't sound credible on the phone, you're probably not going to get much past that phone call, right, with any broker that's reputable, because the brokers – one of the main jobs of the broker is to assess credibility of any potential buyer so they can then go to the seller, their client, and kind of size up the lay of the land. So if you come in and you don't have a basic level of education, you know, you don't know what NOI means, you don't know how to calculate it, you don't understand some of the acronyms in the business like RUBS, ratio utility billing system, where you bill back the water sewer to the tenant. So if you can't have very basic industry jargon and understanding it, you're probably too early to be talking to a broker in the first place. So, you know, I would certainly start by listening to a bunch of podcasts. Those are good ways and free to learn about some basic industry jargon. You know, our podcast specifically about apartments, or your podcast, you have different topics, but that's a good place to start, because obviously you're hearing us if you're listening to a podcast. Another good way to start would be maybe reading some books on the topic. You know, I personally like the Ken McElroy two books that he has out, the ABCs of Real Estate Investing and the Advanced Real Estate Investing Guides or something like that. Those are both really good books as well to kind of read. And then next step would be to kind of join, like, go to meet like local real estate investing clubs, meetup groups, things like that, maybe even join a mentoring program. So those are some of the ways you get educated. Assuming that you have that basic level of education and speak intelligently, using industry jargon, you know, like you mentioned, when you talk to these brokers on the phone, you need to make sure when you're talking to them, you know what you're looking for and what you want. What the quickest way to kind of be dismissed by a broker or one of them is if you say, "Hey, I'm looking for a good deal." Like, well, what do you want? So, "Oh, just a good deal." You know, well, what location do you want? What part of the town? What metro are you in? What asset class are you in? And if you can't answer those types of things, and you kind of develop what like I call a 60-second pitch, you know, the broker's not going to take you seriously. So for example, I'll give you my basic elevator pitch of what I'm looking for. So when I talk to a broker, you know, what I'm looking for is Class B multifamily properties in the suburban DFW area and the good parts of town. So we're going to the low crime areas, near employment centers, and places where people want to be that are 10 to 15% below market rents that have like a light value add story that I can go in and put agency debt on out of the gate. And that's my basic pitch right there. It's very specific. I know exactly where I want to buy, know exactly what I want to buy. And I would also say it'd be 150 units and greater as well. That I'd also include that elevator pitch. I know the size I want to buy. I know that I want to have it where it's eligible to get Fannie Mae loans on it out of the gate. So saying that to the brokers a lot better, gives you a lot more credibility than if you just come and say, hey, I want a good deal. I don't care what market it in or what part of town it in. I just want 10 cap or better.
I noticed you don't even mention cap in your pitch.
No, because cap rates are very subjective, and I don't think cap rate is necessarily the best measurement about a deal. I mean, it's obviously the way people kind of try to compare two deals apples to apples. But if I buy a deal that has a lot of upside in it, but it's just run by a really poor operator, you know, the cap rate's going to be really, really bad going in. But if I know I can go do, you know, some exterior work, upgrade the mini set and upgrade the units, so I can raise rents $200, you know, I don't really care so much about what my cap rate is going in because my returns on the back end will be there and I can go in and make it work.
Does it matter to say you're looking for value add deal, or does that hinder?
No. Yeah, that's definitely something, you know, that and basically when you're looking at apartments, you know, there's usually kind of two types. You call it like a yield play or value play. So yield play or yield property would be something that's working well, that's, you know, out of the gate, that's already been renovated, and you're just going to go in and kind of buy it and operate it in a similar fashion what the current owner has. Or you have the value add property that's either distressed or just underperforming for, you know, either management, mismanagement of the property, and or they're undercapitalized and not doing the proper, you know, maintenance of the property or upgrading the units to keep up with the competing properties and what everyone around you are doing. And then sometimes you kind of be in the middle and kind of be a hybrid of those two, but usually it's either value play or yield play. And if you're looking to go in and try to force some level of value add into the property, which is something that's a key component to virtually every deal that we do, we just don't want to necessarily buy them unless we can come in and force a little bit of value. That is certainly something you want to make sure you let the broker know, because he doesn't want to show you. He wants to show you the right property. He doesn't want to show you every property. So he wants to make sure he kind of matches the right buyer with the right property and try to, you know, that would help increase his likelihood of getting that deal closed, which is when he gets paid.
Right. And you also don't mention anything about, let's say, you know, coming in under market. You don't want to get something that's, you know, maybe 10% under market or something. I mean, would that be a turnoff for the brokers for the most part?
Yeah, I would think so. When you talk about pricing, I mean, I think it's certainly okay to say that you're targeting properties that are below market and they're in-place rental rates. So their rents are $800 for this type of on average, and the neighboring property that's a little bit more upgraded is charging $900 a month. You know, so that'd be okay that you're targeting something 10 to 12% below market rents. But, you know, if you're coming in trying to steal a property off of a guy, that's certainly not a way to endear you. And then if it's a marketed deal, it's the market's going to get exposed to it. If, as long as the broker's, you know, worth anything, the market's going to find the deal, and it'll get priced up accordingly to what the market's going to bear.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, out of the 21, you have 16 are off market. Now, the other remaining, I mean, are those just from the receipt of OMs, or is that stuff that's on the market? Where did those come from?
Yeah, so we sign up for every major brokerage shop in DFW and all the smaller regional ones and kind of the one-off guys. We pretty much try to see every deal that gets put out on the marketplace. Whether we buy them or not, we certainly want to download the OMs, track that data, because it's always good to get more data about what's going on in the marketplace and kind of follow through and see what they actually traded for, because it's good information. But the ones that were not off market were, you know, basically they went to market. Some of these were a few years ago when the market wasn't quite as strong as it is today. We were able to get what we think are fair deals. And even the deals that go to market, you know, you don't have to steal it if you can get a fair price on it. You have good level of upside. and or it happens to be located, you know, around the corner or next door to another property that we own, and we can have some sort of economies of scale that maybe the next guy can't have. We can potentially have a little bit more efficiencies and underwrite it a little bit more aggressively than what maybe someone else can if we, you know, control a few deals in a submarket.
Right. Now, talking about first contact with a broker, how would you recommend? Let's say they've got their education, they're pretty good at understanding the terminology, and they've got a good idea of what exactly their criteria is. First contact. How would you see that being to be most favorable for an investor?
So what I would do is I would certainly go ahead and get on the list of all the major brokerage firms in the area I want to buy in. So just get on all their mailing lists and their distribution list. And then when they send out their deals coming to market, you go in, most of them will make you sign an electronic confidentiality agreement. So sign the CA, and then you get the marketing package. And from there, I would go ahead, I would do an underwriting of the deal, make sure I kind of, you know, understand it, and then I would schedule a tour with these brokers. And that's a good way to go out and actually meet them in person. So do a basic underwriting, get a tour set up, and then go walk the property. And then by, you know, walking that property with them for 15 to 30 minutes, you get to establish some basic level of rapport. They get to put a face with a name. You know, that's not just a person behind an email screen. You know, you're actually someone that went out and took the time to go meet them in person, you know, kind of follow through on that. You know, a really important thing from there would be whether you're interested in this deal or you're not interested in this deal. You should follow up with the broker and say, hey, you know, this deal doesn't work for me because of X, Y, and Z. I don't understand that. I don't think you can get the same rental rates that you're projecting that I can get, or I don't like whatever about this property. But make sure you always follow through with the broker and give them very specific feedback on why you like it or why you don't like it. So they know that you're serious and you underwrote the deal and you took the time to do that. And they're humans. They put something out there. They want to get some feedback one way or another. But what it also does, it, you know, allows you another time to talk to them, build a little bit more rapport, as well as it helps kind of define in their mind, you know, okay, Bill, you don't like properties that are next to open piece of land. So this property happened to be next to a big open parcel. You're worried about new supply. Let me not show Bill that. So if he sees something that has that, they know that might not be the property for you. But if they find one that's in a completely built out infill area, that might be something that appeals to you, for example, and really kind of just defines in the mind what you're looking for and what your buying criteria is going to be.
Yeah, the big thing I think of when you mention that is that, okay, is he really going to remember what I like and what I don't like? I mean, these guys must talk to tons of people every day. And how do you kind of keep in their sight, but at the same time, not be obnoxious by, you know, calling them every other day?
Yeah. So once you've established some basic level of rapport and, you know, had a in-person meeting with them, you know, the technology is great and doing stuff over the phone and email is great, but nothing really substitutes in my mind getting an face-to-face meeting with somebody that really, really goes a long way. And I think from there, you know, just staying on top of them, you know, have like a bi-weekly call, you know, every other Tuesday you sit down and call all the brokers in town, talk through and say, hey, what else do you have coming up? You got any deals coming out? What are you seeing? You know, what are you bidding on that you're not going to win the listing on? Is there anything you think I can take off market? Those are the type of things that I do. I'm just constantly getting in touch with them on a pretty frequent basis and just checking into what's going on in their world in the marketplace. You know, another thing we do, which helps us underwrite the deals, is we have a lot of subscriptions to data services like CoStar and ALN, or another one would be like Axiometrics. So those are kind of the data services for the apartment industry, and CoStar does other asset classes as well. And we have all those data services. So some of the times what we do to help try to get some off-market deals is we'll partner with the broker instead of calling direct to ownership groups. We'll pull a geographical area that we want to be in. So in a suburb of Dallas, would say, like, is a city called Garland. So Garland has about 250,000 people in it. So we like Garland. We want to be north of this street, south of that street. And we're looking for all the properties properties built between 1970 and 1990 that are 100 units and up. And we'll kind of do a filter of all those properties and look through the data service at ones that the AOLN or CoStar is telling us are, say, like 10% or below, or more below market rents compared to its peers. And that's a good target list. So we'll take that list and we'll partner up with a broker or several brokers. We'll kind of break the list up into different sections and ask for this broker saying, hey, Mr. Broker, these are properties that if we can agree to a price on, we'd buy any of these properties. So, you know, here's a list for you to go call on my behalf. And the brokers love that, right? So the brokers are, their job is basically to make phone calls all day, every day, and talk to owners and potential buyers of properties. So if they can have a list and call a owner of a property and specifically say that active buyer in the marketplace specifically asked for me to call on your property and see if you'd be interested in selling, they're going to be on the phone anyways. That's a lot easier telephone call for them to have. And it's kind of a way that you're giving them something. You're not just taking it from them. You're giving them a list and you're giving them, you know, an ability to make a phone call that's a little bit more warm than a normal cold call that they make all the time.
Right. And are they also a source for you of maybe new submarkets or other areas where there's a really good potential? Did you ever get that kind of lead from them?
Sometimes, so we get deals where we do a lot of business with a local brokerage shop called ARA, their national shop, but we do a lot of business with their Dallas office. So sometimes I get a phone call from my guy in Dallas, and that they have a property in Oklahoma City that their counterpart in Oklahoma City is going to bring out. I think is a good value. He's not getting the traction on this specific deal because they had a bunch of road work right in front of the property. It's been going on for the last year. It's caused a little dip in occupancy, and it seems like this owner might sell at what they believe is a fair price. Do I want to look at it? So sometimes I get things like that. But for myself, generally, we own only one market right now. We are looking in Houston and maybe Oklahoma City, but Houston, we're also looking there as well, because I think there's some opportunity there. So I pretty much know where I want to be in my market. So I don't necessarily find out new stuff about, or a new submarket I didn't already know about. I might find out some facts about the submarket that, you know, so-and-so, my competitor down the street, went in and bought this property, renovated X number of units, or raised the rents that I might not know about. And that can maybe be a little tip I get from them, but necessarily finding a different submarket, I don't think that's something I would necessarily get just by being so ingrained into my local market.
Right. When you buy, do you have a fixed exit strategy? I mean, are you looking, because you're dealing with investors and turning the property over in 3 to 5 years or 5 to 7 or anything like that, or are you looking to hold?
Yeah, so everything's just a depends answer for sure. Each deal's a little different, but generally speaking, when you're going into a deal and you have a syndicated ownership structure where you have a bunch of unrelated people that all pool their capital together, having a clear defined exit strategy in a reasonably short period of time, like 3 to 5 years, is usually what it's going to take. Because when someone gives you your money, Bill, they're going to want to see a return of it in the not too distant future. So most people don't want to be in these deals forever. And you and the 20 other people that are going to deal with me all have different life events that happen along the way. So having a near to medium term return of capital is certainly something that you should have a clearly defined exit. And it should go in and align with the business plan of the property. So if I'm buying a value property that's underperforming currently, I'm going to go in, fix it up, raise the rents $100 and increase the value. That clearly is a story that leads to a quicker exit than if I go buy a yield property that works perfectly today. I go put on a 10 or 12 year fixed rate loan. Trying to have an exit strategy in 2 to 3 years doesn't really align so much with the type of property you're buying, and having a short exit really that disaligns. So you want to make sure that the deal story aligns with your exit as well.
I just want to look a little bit too on the sort of the underwriting, analyzing part of it. I mean, you definitely had an advantage there going into it as an investor, because you really know what, at least on the financial side, what they're looking for. What sort of your advice to folks that are looking to, you know, analyze these deals for a good return and also to better understand the deal?
Yeah. So, you know, That's right. That's something that I certainly had from my professional career. There's a couple ways you can learn. You know, I mentioned before, you know, obviously listening to podcasts are a good, very high level way of doing it. Reading books, there's several books out there that can kind of talk about the basics of underwriting a deals and kind of the expense categories. Those are certain ways, or if you join like a mentoring program that get very specific education on how to underwrite apartment complexes, those are all good resources to learn that. You know, but at its core, this is relatively simple business, Bill. And that's what I really like about it. Apartments are really simple. They're kind of a dumb thing to buy, really. You just rent it out and you pay expenses, and the difference is what you keep. But there's a lot of, you know, it's not always easy, and there's a lot of nuances to it. But, you know, generally speaking, with some of these data services, like I mentioned, CoStar and ALN, you pretty much have the rents down cold. It's pretty easy to find out what a property should be renting for. You'll know what they are currently renting if you just look at their rent roll and what they're getting on average for each unit type they have. And then one of these data services can tell you what the competing properties are doing for the rental rate. So that's the easiest way to do it. Kind of the more old school way would be to just find out all the comps in the area, pick up the phone and ask them what they're renting the units for, and or secret shop them. And that's a good way to find out kind of what the market revenue is for that type, that unit type in that submarket. On the expense side, you certainly, if you look at a deal that's on the market or off market, and you're able to get financial statements, you'll kind of see what they're charging on a historic basis. And then you that's kind of like your starting point. And then you kind of really work on adjusting that budget. So really, when we're looking at a historic property, what we would typically just really focus on from the expense side is what their insurance cost is, what their utility costs are, and then what their property taxes are. And then from there, we'll certainly get our own insurance quote, and then we'll adjust the tax number typically upwards. So if they're assessed at a lower tax value by the county assessor versus what we're paying, we know our property taxes are going to go up within the first year or so. So we'll underwrite to a little higher tax number. And then from there, there's typically some industry norms, you know, on ALN or Axiometrics or CoStar, or I think the Urban Land Institute. They'll give you by metro market, I believe, the average cost for what it's going to take to do repairs and maintenance on a 1970 built property in that area, and then what payroll should be, and there should be some like standardized categories by unit type. So, you know, we typically underwrite, say, $1,100 a unit payroll, for example. That's what we'll underwrite in most properties, and some can get to $1,050 and some have to be $1,200 a unit. And really, it depends, and that's kind of the nuances of it. But on real high level basics, we have kind of our template plug that we have for operating expenses by unit type. And that's kind of how we do our really quick first pass of the deal. And then from there, we then kind of fine tune it once we get into it. And but having some very kind of rules of thumb, very plug, that's the way you quickly get through these deals and see if it looks like it makes sense on the surface and you should spend some more time on it, or this looks so out of whack, you don't want to waste any more time on it, throw in the trash heap and move on to the next one.
Right. With OMs, and it sounds like you probably get a ton of them in your email on a regular basis. What really sort of the first two, three things that you look at to even see if you want to read any further?
So the first thing is, where is it located? So if I know it's an area that is high crime or, you know, like low economic development, kind of those are the areas we don't want to buy in. So that's the first and foremost. So if it's in the hood, I'm not gonna spend any more time on it. It's just delete and I move on with my life. So if it's in a good location and is in some of a size that I want to look at, so you know if it's 150 or 200 units or larger, then we'll start digging into it. So if it's you know, generally speaking, if it's a brand new property, Class A, we don't look at those. If it's a super old deal anymore, like a 1960s, it has aluminum wiring and cast iron sewers. Those are properties that, you know, I've certainly owned in the past, and I still own a handful of them. But those are not what I want to buy nowadays. I want to buy kind of the B product that are built in the 80s or the 90s and the better suburban markets. So that's kind of where I start. And then from there, you know, what's the basic deal story? So typically in the OM, it'll tell you kind of in the kind of the description part of it, what the basic deal story is. Does this have a value add, or has the owner currently, you know, the previous owner or the current owner previously buy it and upgrade all the units and there's no real value to be created? So if that's the case, we probably won't go any further because that's not what I want to buy. I want to buy something I can come in and force a little bit of value to. And then from there, it's just like, how much value is there? And is you know, do I think it's practical and reasonable on the surface that I can go in and, you know, this property's only only renting for $800 a month, but the market seems to be $900 a month market. That makes sense to me, and I'll go in and spend a little bit more time on it.
That's great. That's invaluable. Well, Mike, man, this literally zipped by here. I'm kind of going, wait a minute, I got about 50 more questions for you. But this is really, really good information. Anything that we didn't talk about that should have touch on?
Yeah, you know, a couple other ways, I think, you know, I want to pound the table here that the things that, you know, you need to do, you know, is really just go out and start getting in relationships with people. People are not going to, no one comes to my office and hands me money, Bill. You know, I got to get out there and go get it, right? So I go to a lot of conferences. You know, there's apartment conferences I go to, either my local town or like, say, Marcus and Miller Chapel hold an annual event. I go to it because a lot of other ownership groups are there and a lot of brokers are there. So I go to those events. Like here at Old Capital, we host the Old Capital Speaker Series once a quarter, and we have a lot of our clients come out. So you get to network with a lot of like the other investors in the local marketplace as well as brokers. So that's the way you need to get out. You need to get your face in front of these people and shake their hand, look them in the eye. And that's the best way to start establishing a rapport, because people do business with people they know and like. And if they don't know you and they don't like you, they're not going to likely do business with you. So that's really it's a business you need to get out of your house and go meet people. So I can't stress that enough, or go into events where you go network with, learn about how to syndicate real estate deals. Those are events that I go to and have gone to in the past. So that would be one of the things that you just really need to get out there and do it if you're serious in this business. It's great to listen to the podcast and read the books, but you know, you're not going to make any money doing those two things.
That's great. Great advice. Wow. Well, how can people get a hold of you, Mike? Maybe there's people that are interested in what you do and would like to find out more. What's the best way?
A couple things, like you mentioned. Certainly, our Old Capital Real Estate Investing Podcast is in iTunes, Stitcher, and all the major podcast aggregators, or at oldcapitalpodcast.com. That's our website. Or if you want to learn more about kind of how we raise money and buy apartments, the business we do that under is called SPI Advisory, like Spy Advisory. It's spiadvisory.com. That's our website. Or my email is simply mbecker@spiadvisory.com. I'm always open to answering some quick questions over email, or even scheduling potentially a 10 or 15 minute call with anyone if they're interested.
Wow, really appreciate that, Mike. Well, Mike, you know, this we have a tradition here you're well familiar with by now. and we're going to close out with, you know, I think people in Texas just know, you know, how hound dogs sound. And, you know, so we're going to have our listeners judge that themselves. So are you ready to close us out with your best old hound dog howl?
Here we go. Oh, wow, wow, wow.
All right, that was good. All right, Mike. Well, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. And it's great topic here. I also want to thank all of our old dog listeners out there too for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we greatly appreciate it. Please note, everything that Mike talked about today will be in our show notes, which are located in our olddogsreinetwork.com/blog area. And you can just look it up by either Mike's name or the episode itself. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king, real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward, and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.